Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, whatever you're doing, continue to do it. This is Radio Deepest of the Arts and Deep Beneath the Arts. You may join us entirely as you knit, as you drive, as you eat, as you paint, as you mend the lawnmower, as you pleasure yourself or another, as you will and as you are. I open my soft felt guest bag today and find a surfeit of splendor, a glut of glory, and, to be Shavian for the first and last time this century, a dilemma of doctors, all of them too true to be good. I offer, in no particular order, the splendor of Professor Anthony Clare, the glory of Sinead O'Connor, the radiance of Dr. Jonathan Miller, the fragile beauty of Professor Laurie Taylor, the elfin gamine grace as ever of John Sessions, the roseate glow of Arnold Wesker, the violent loveliness of Tom Baker. The elements are so mixed in them that all nature might stand up and say, "These are guests." And as the sound of the mighty Wurlitzer of Roy Wooten and Bob Barrett playing House Proud, House Frau, I kid you not, fades away, it's BBC Radio 4. The time is now, the place is between your ears. Welcome to Saturday Night Fried. You know, Lovelitz, there was a time when I rather thought about the possibility of the Anglican priesthood. I could, being Jewish on the distaff, the side that counts, have considered the rabbinacy, I suppose. But for me, high Anglicanism held me in its thrall. Not uncommon urge amongst the adolescent, I think. Let me just whiz quickly about the table and see if any of our guests have ever felt a religious vocation in any direction. Anna Wesker.
No.
I think that's emphatic. I think that's clear. What about you, Anthony Clare?
Yes. I was Jesuit educated. Need I say any more?
Oh, my goodness. No, I'm sorry to hear it. Jonathan Miller?
No, I never felt it. I was a cradle atheist.
Excellent. Sinead O'Connor.
I was fanatically religious as a child and therefore quite frightened that I might want to become a nun one day, so I used to pray to God to make me never want to be a nun.
Excellent. If that isn't nourished, I don't know what is. John Sessions?
Never been drawn in any particular direction, but I'm sadly afraid of hell because no one's come back.
Tom Baker.
Yes, I was brought up a very violent Roman Catholic and was very interested in martyrdom from the word go, yes.
Oh, excellent. What about you, Laurie Taylor?
Yes, I was a Roman Catholic as well, and Christian Brothers educated, and my mother used to say to me from the age of 5 or 6, tell me if you're having a vocation, and I said, how would I know? She had a special feeling, and I got this special feeling one day. It wasn't a vocation, but I reported to her as a vocation. I was immediately dispatched to a priest training college.
And you had the vocation sucked out of you, no doubt. Well, I suppose that's good and interesting. I don't personally regret my flirtation with Christianity, nor the hours spent reading my Bultmann and Aquinas and Cloud of Unknowing, nor my perfervid desire to be washed clean by the Lamb. I wanted to be washed clean because everything I had been taught told me that I was dirty. Religion was the first multinational to discover the common sales trick beloved now by advertisers everywhere. Tell them they stink and then you can sell them deodorant. But what has religion come to now? There was a time when at least God had on his side Bach and Michelangelo, Masaccio and Messiaen. Now it would seem that he has gunning for him nothing but a parcel of mimsy, prissy, mealy-mouthed, witless mediocrities whose idea of glory and the infinite is to talk about a kind of sharing and outreach fellowship. Tinted, spectacled horrors who spend their time writing gross and impertinent letters to the newspapers about the bedroom habits of people they have never met and cleaving to precisely the least interesting and most soul-deadening sections of the revealed texts that they propagate with such humorless and conspicuously non-divine zeal. Hello, who's rattled Stevie's cage then? Well, maybe I'm a tad unfair, but what I wanted to say was that religion's appeal resided for me, I think, in its completeness, its syllogistically sealed arguments, everything was necessary and sufficient only unto itself, an a prioristically perfect circle that looped itself around you. Logic, all the danger and difficulty of humanism and the strange, awful beauty of reason yield to uncertainty and a lack of clarity. But the age of reason is over. This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius. Aquarius, the water carrier, who replaces the wine of enlightenment, the clarity of wine, if you like, with the water of pseudo-mysticism, wishy-washing away centuries of thought and effort. It's not the most original insight in the world to say that now, year by year, or year on year, if you must, that section of the bookshop dedicated to self-help expands by another 5 yards of shelving. Self, self, self by the shelf, shelf, shelf. Self-help as cognitive psychotherapy, management guruism, spiritual guidance, the Zen of this, the Tao of that. The world seems to be screaming for help, for answers. Answers to what? answers to questions that only the misguided, the forlorn, the uneducated and the enslaved would ever think to ask of a book. How can I be happy, successful, loved and valued? Questions well worth the asking of oneself, and questions that anyone with a religion, a system or a book to sell would love to answer for you. Is it snobbish or pretentious to say that the answers to those questions are more likely to be found in a Mozart piano concerto, a Velasquez painting, a windy day on a wild coast, the smile of a friend, a line of Shakespeare, the sight of a swallow building its nest, the sweaty fever of a dance floor, or the beautiful ticking of a great engine? I suppose it probably is, but the greatest game of all is let's pretend, and that's bound to lead to pretentiousness. Frankly, it's pretentious to be scared of pretension and to avoid all excitement and passion. These are the kind of things I'd like my guests here to help me with today. So I turn to our first doctor. Doctor of Letters, University of East Anglia. Doctor of Humane Letters, Denison University, Ohio. The inimitable, indomitable Dr. Arnold Wesker. This is the section of the program I love to call, in that way I have, Work in Progress. Now, Benedict Nightingale wrote that one day the OED would contain the word to Wesker, verb intransitive, to display an intense intellectual curiosity, to wax didactic about the state of society, to defend the idealist and resist the pragmatist. So, Dr. Wesker, in what directions have you been Weskering lately?
I've just finished a play called Denial, which is about the false memory syndrome, on a case that I've come in contact with.
Oh, really? Is it something you believe in? That it is false, a lot of these therapies?
There is something very fishy abroad, and I'd be very interested to know what Anthony thinks. Certainly the couple I met, whose story I've more or less recreated, persuade me that the daughter was vulnerable and was manipulated. Now, I'm actually more interested in the personality of the manipulator. I've written plays about the priest as manipulator, the politician, the journalist as manipulator. And when I was told this story, it suddenly struck me, yes, here's another story about the manipulator. The responses from theatres, and I tell you very frankly and immediately that most of the major theatres have turned it down, saying, this is wonderful writing, very exciting play, ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum-ba-dum, but we think you have demonized the therapist.
Maybe some of the difficulties you're encountering are also because the issue of child sexual abuse itself is so hard for people, such a hot potato, you know, in the art world. About, like, I know because I've written songs, say, about similar things, or, you know, that it can be a subject which people find they get very uncomfortable about having it put in their face, you know. So maybe it's more the issue of sexual abuse than the issue of false memory, which creates a difficulty for the theatre.
Yeah, well, I was very aware of this when I began, and I was also aware that there was the possibility of demonising the therapist. So I think that I've made the therapist an absolutely fairly drawn character with a big, big defence speech. But a distinction is made in the play between child abuse and adults who choose their parents.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I would say that I would hazard a guess that the difficulty is probably the subject matter as such. Whether you dealt with false memory or not, if you dealt with sexual abuse, you would come across a difficulty.
Yeah, it surprises me. Yeah.
Listen, this is something we're going to come back to, because this is really the meat and drink of, I hope, our conversation. But I'd like to turn just to finish off your work in progress section. I know you're writing these erotic stories, which we hope will be published soon, and we do hope Denial will be shown. But I know also that you've written a play, Letter to a Daughter. Would you like to tell us about it?
Yeah, it's a play simply about a singer who is writing a letter to her daughter for when she's age 14. The daughter's aged 11 now, and she thinks it's going to be a letter of advice, but as it progresses, it turns out to be a letter confessing guilt for having been an inadequate parent. And the play is punctuated by six songs, which I wrote the lyrics, and Bentil, this, I think, brilliant young composer, has composed the music, and Julie Clare sings wonderfully.
Arnold Wesker, thank you very much indeed. Now then, our doctor number two, and I don't mean a proctologist, is regular and favourite John Sessions, isn't actually a doctor, but he would be if he'd bothered to finish his PhD on Henry James instead of running off to RADA and becoming a mincer. As always, he is here with a tale to tell as he takes us on a journey through the world of happiness. And as the French waiter says to newlyweds Peter Sellers and Goldie Hawn in There's a girl in my soup. I hope you have happiness all your life. Are we missing out on happiness because we're too serious? We shall all hold hands now and listen in childish rapt wonder and glee as Harold Pinter wonders whether perhaps what he needs is a good night out.
Outrageous. Got to be a revolution.
Tom Stoppard speaking. How may my wordplay delight you?
Tom, it's Harold. Pinter, of course. Oh, stop that step door, Robin's horseshit. It drives me mental. Listen, we may not have much time. We may be tapped. I'm watching a ghastly TV program about the new production of Strindberg's The Father at the Guildhall in Shaftesbury Avenue. Al Pacino and Sue Pollard are starring, as I assume you know. Sue Pollard with a redoubtable Pacino. Words fail me.
Words must never fail you, Harold.
Words never do fail me, Tom. God damn it. Life fails me. Art appears bent on failing us all. Look, it's that West End Theatre Roundup on Carlton TV.
Oh, I like that program. It's delicious fun.
It's not fun, Tom. It's hell. On this earth. The Pollard factor I can countenance. Barely. It's the girl who's playing the daughter. Do you know who they've cast? The girlfriend of Michael Owen, the footballer. Listen, Tom. Strindberg must not be desecrated by some cheap publicity stunt. His darkness must remain pure. What's that noise?
It's the party.
The party? The party's dead as mutton. New Labour? Oh, my God, I've just seen you on television. Talking to me. It can't be Prozac. I've never touched it.
Harold, you are not the victim of a drug-crazed cerebellum. You are looking at me on TV. Look, I'm waving at you.
I'm here at the first night of The Father. Strindberg, red in tooth and claw. And such a revelation in the performance of the daughter. A sweet young girl plucked from untrammeled anonymity, unblemished by the staring-eyed, tiger-balmed self-obsession that is the distinguishing stigma of the juvenile RSC actress. Look, I've got Michael Owen on the phone. He's so delighted with his girlfriend's ravishing brilliance.
No, Tom, I'll ring off. I had no idea you were there in that media cesspit.
No, no, Harold. Tarry a while. Here is our heroic young Sidney Carton, fresh from his glory in Paris, with his head absolutely upon his sane young shoulders. Michael, you must talk to the dramatic wizard I was telling you about. A moment, Michael. Harold, this is the mighty atom, Michael Owen. I provided a brief but vivid précis of your career. He particularly wants signed Matthew and copies of The Homecoming, No Man's Land, The Caretaker, and Moonlight as soon as humanly. Alas, I cannot persuade him to smoke, but then that would diabolize his footballing perfection, and he would fall further than the foulest professional foul. Look, I'm handing him the phone.
Mr. Pinter, Michael Owen, my girlfriend has just told me what Mr. Stopper told me you said about her, you know, that she was brilliant, and, you know, I'll level with you, you know, on her behalf, like I did with Mr. Stoppard. You know, I'm not sure, you know, she really wanted to do Strindberg, but, you know, I got to tell you, you know, it's a real honor that Britain's greatest playwright should ring up the theatre after seeing her. You know, she's so...
Mr. Owen, the honor is mine, I assure you. I'm delighted to speak to someone so... your football is sublime. And had I been there at the theatre tonight, I was there, of course I was there. I just got home very quickly on a powerful motorbike. Yes, your girlfriend's performance was certainly quite... just hand me back, will you, to my friend with the luxuriant hair.
No problem, Mr. Pinter. And, thank you. Luxuriant hair. Mr. Pacino! Al! Mr. Pinter wants you.
No, Michael! I want Mr. Stoppard. Oh, God, Al. How can I tell him I wasn't there?
How old? Yeah, it's Al. Yeah, I can't hear you above all the hoopa hell we got here. Yeah, I'm so excited. Can you believe it? I just met Michael Owen. It's like meeting Marlon Brando for the first time in The Godfather. Well, Harold, we bitched up August Strindberg, my friend. Big-ass time. Ooh-ha. Sarah Pollard. She is a friggin' fine. In fact, I got her right here. Hey, Sarah. And what? Oh, Sue, come over here. Yeah, I got a guy on the phone for you.
Oh, thanks, Al. Oh, the big brown eyes. I could shampoo me hair in him. Hello? Who am I having the pleasure of? Harold Pinter? Oh, I never had the honor, but I have to say, I shouldn't say, I'll just sound daft. I have to say, this is sounding like one of your plays, isn't it? Oh, mysterious and scary. That birthday party thing of yours had me filling my knickers. Excuse my Norwegian. Oh, no, that's the other one, isn't it? Him with the doll's ass. I'm sorry, House.
You are sensational, Sue. As indeed you always were in Heidi High.
Don't screw with the sensibilities of an oh-so-sensitive artiste, Harold. You wasn't here, my friend. Tom told me how you've been playing friggin' hooky on us here.
I'm sorry, I can explain. I would have been there, only I...
I'm kidding you, Dawson-ass. You're a busy man, we understand. But it's a real shame, because there's a big surprise I fixed up for you. Someone you'd like to meet. I wish you'd have been here to shake his demented hand. I got August Strindberg here for the first night. Yeah, that's the kind of shit you can swing when you got my money. Should have done that Godzilla script, Harold, when you had a chance. I'm handing him over now.
Thank you, Al. Oh, Harold, Harold Pinter. This is me, August. I am as deeply barking as I've always been. Never, you see, been able to reconcile the mother with the lover, with the life, with the death. A moment, I'll just inject myself with something soothing. Now I am as balanced as John Osborne. I got to say that Al and Sue Pollard have done the father more than justice. I'm as mad as a Stockholm cat with seven arseholes, but I have to say, I'm happy. Happy, I tell you.
You hear that, Harold? August is over the moon. You should have seen him here with Terry Venables. They've been talking penalty box shit all night. August thinks the Moroccan rat was Ibsen. How'd you like that? We are having one party here, Harold. You got to get your ass over here now, because we have missed you, my friend. Come on.
I'll be there. You have my word.
Oh, why didn't I go tonight? Why? I should still be able to get a cab. Michael Owen and lots of young people talking with Al Pacino. And it would be nice to meet August Strindberg. How is it Al can summon up a playwright dead since 1912? I'll ask him. And I'm sure I can remember some bits from Heidi High to engage Sue. Oh, why shouldn't Michael Owen's girlfriend be lovely in the part? Oh, I should have gone, should have been there, been solid with them all. But I'm going now. I'm going to forget art, dance, be happy, and have fun.
Oh, John Sessions, thank you so much for that. Thank you very much indeed. Now, next up, an Irishman, our doctor, and I don't mean a proctologist, is the Professor of Clinical Psychiatry at Trinity College Dublin, whose psychiatrist chair on this station has cushioned the plump bottom of 17 series worth of self-revealing maundering celebs, myself included. Vengeance is now mine. Ha-ha. Best served cold with a béarnaise sauce. Professor Anthony Clare, I'm talking about, of course, the man with a voice that sounds like Bailey's Irish cream being poured onto the milk-white buttocks of a Kerry Colleen. I'm sorry, I don't get carried away there. And with him...
Speaking from experience.
Neurologist. And with him, neurologist, thinker, director, writer, dweller in the life of the mind, Dr. Jonathan Miller. Jonathan, Oliver James, I think, claimed in one of his books that we are less happy. I don't know what psychometric test he used to say this, but that we are, I think he claimed, 40% less happy than we were 50 years ago, or whatever.
Did he really? 40%?
Whether it was 40% or not, I don't know. It was 8%, it seems to me, any it's a pretty bizarre claim, whether it's 1 or 70.
But might that be not that there's been a change in the level of happiness, but the level of expectation of what we have a right to...
That's what I was going to ask.
What we have a right to in the way of satisfaction and happiness. That one of the things which... And it isn't just psychotherapy. It's not just Freud, Adler, Jung, Klein, and the others who have possibly reduced our happiness, but the doctrine has... introduced people to the possibility that by fiddling with expert advice that you might in fact be able to make people happier. I mean, it's not just that. It is also one of the products of the spread of democracy and of the notion of individualism, that if you spread the idea of the sanctity of the individual and that the individual is in fact only fulfilled if he or she meet some sort of satisfaction which any given society agrees to be the standards by which people are satisfied, then you raise the expectations to perhaps levels which can't possibly be fulfilled.
Yes, it's like Auden's view, isn't it?
I don't know about that.
That our neuroses are the sort of rosin by which we grip the stage of life. And I suppose in the 60s and early 70s there was that one flew over the cuckoo's nest view that, you know, take away our madness and you take away our individuality. But I think what Jonathan said about, you know, the rise of the primacy of self is also muddied by, in a sense, the removal of the subject, the removal of self, the removal of our individual determining place in history through Marx or in our consciousness through Freud, that we are simultaneously bigger than we ever were as individuals and smaller.
That's the psychologizing of the world that you're talking about.
Laurie Taylor.
I mean, because there are probably, if you looked at undergraduate courses, there are more psychologists probably than almost any other discipline going, and the world is full of therapists, the world is full of counselors, and that is related, and you might expect me to say this as a sociologist, to the way in which people have been over the last 30 years or so constrained to believe that the source of anything which is ill about the world actually lies within themselves. Whereas 30, 40 years ago, it was perfectly possible for people to see the political parties as being a necessity to do something about changing the nature of the world, the structure of the world, the inequalities of the world, and to throw themselves into it, whether they threw themselves into it through political parties or through trade unions or whatever. But this business of the politics is personal, I mean, we might sort of like blame the liberation movements of the so-called 60s for insisting that you could actually go on being political by examining navel-gazing, examining yourself, summoning up some internal thing.
That, you know, therapy like money or power belongs to those who lead it least. And we must be careful. The people listening to this program, some of them, you know, are the mothers of seriously ill or fathers of seriously ill people or seriously ill themselves. And what comes out of them, people in with serious physical illness, with serious psychiatric disorders, is a constant refrain, which is, you cannot find a therapist. There are no psychiatrists.
Yes.
Where are the counselors?
And the national
people
health...
I'm not just talking about people with psychiatric disorders. No. Somebody crippled with disseminated sclerosis or Parkinson's disease, struggling to make sense of an illness, to make sense of the therapies, to make sense of the limits of what we know, much of that would be called a kind of psychotherapy. Counselling is part of what medicine's all about, but it has been very seriously devalued over the same century that has seen the flowering of the all-embracing, ready-to-provide, caring, loving empathy and genuineness counsellor that the, if you like, that the talking classes talk about. And that's when they say there's counselling all over the place. There is indeed, but it's not,
nobody can afford it.
People want it or need it.
But I think it's very true what I'm saying, that although there has been this enormous emphasis upon caring, it's extremely unequally and inequitably distributed, that people who in fact need it most are in fact not given access to it, that all the counselling and advice and therapy does in fact tend to be directed towards people who can afford to pay for it, and that enormous numbers of people who really do need it. Now, of course, there would be a sort of conservative strain in English and in American society which would say, well, this is just self-indulgence, that no one needs it, and that we've lost that wonderful thing we once had, which was moral fibre, which we all constrain upon if we need to.
But there is a great sense in Britain that we are somehow, or have been, morally superior to the Americans because, you know, we don't blame some new syndrome that's just been made up. We don't investigate ourselves. We don't pour our psyches all over television. We don't talk about our problems. And part of me feels, yes, that is better than some of the rather weird sort of stuff you see in America. But on the other hand, I've never thought that anything in Britain that it's a kind of miserable emotional constipation is something actually to be proud of or to approve of. And I run hot and cold on this, and I don't know if anyone is like that.
No,
Sinead, I know, I just wanted to say, sorry, cutting across you there, Johnny.
Yeah.
I know you, like me, have been under a therapist or across one or whatever preposition is appropriate. I mean, do you feel it helped you?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think obviously it depends on what your experience is. I mean, if you've been bashed around by a goose, you don't need therapy as much as if you've been raped by your mother or a father. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So I think it depends on what your experience has been, basically. But there are people who actually do need to be taught how to get through a 24-hour period, you know, who haven't been taught that by any of the guiding figures in their lives, you know. So to a certain extent, I think counselling can provide parenting. And grandparenting, and also it takes the place of religion. Religion has failed, really. It used to be that you could go and talk to the priest. It's usually now that you're talking about the priest with the therapist. You know?
But they haven't got to be such melodramatic episodes which make people wretched and miserable. There's a very interesting article in the New York Review of Books last month by Helen Epstein about the incidence of straightforward physical morbidity and mortality in Whitehall, and they discovered that the rate or the incidence of morbidity and mortality was directly related to your position on the social scale within the community. In other words, that you didn't have to be abused by your parents. Merely to be located at one particular position on the social ladder led to a sense of a lack of self-determination, which, when endured for many years, actually made you more susceptible to disease than those who were perhaps 8 levels above you on the ladder. In other words, that without any of these spectacular episodes of being molested or beaten or raped as a child, there are disasters, chronic disasters, that befall you merely by virtue of the fact that where you find yourself in society may lead to such an acute sense of chronic frustration that you die earlier than other people. Yes.
I can see that with physical morbidity and illness, but I would also say, certainly from my own personal experience, one of the troubles of mental distress is that you can feel it acutely under all kinds of circumstances, and one particular piquancy is to feel it and for it to be reinforced by the fact that you feel you have no right to be unhappy because there are no external circumstances that warrant your misery. It is simply illogical for me to be this unhappy.
And, because
it's unfair that these people living in the tidal wave survivor zone of Papua New Guinea seem to be smiling more than I've done for the last 6 months, you say to yourself.
But I think perhaps one of the problems about the argument about therapy is partly the historical evolution of our ideas of it, that the analysts contributed to the notion of therapy as one-to-one, hermetically sealed, an explanation of the internal psyche. It didn't have much sociology, it didn't have much psychology, although actually, in fairness, when they wrote about it, it did, but I'm talking about the way it practiced. And the second problem of some kind of traumatic cause to be unearthed, uncovered, a single cause. I blame, in a way, Jonathan and Arnold's world, because this is very exciting to the world of the cinema. You know, it's been said of the cinema that the cinema and psychiatry needed each other.
Yes.
Well, certainly there's no more powerful image of psychiatry in the cinema than the image of the detective analyst uncovering through internal probings of various kinds a single traumatic cause.
Which is an explanation of human behavior.
We get people now, don't we? There are a large number of people now whose illnesses and unhappiness and inadequacies and sufferings actually turn them into stars and turn them into targets of great attention and turn them into celebrities. Now, to jump from that actually now to television is to the Oprah Winfrey Show or any of those shows where people now, exhibitionists of a certain class and a particular kind of education, actually will get up and become famous for confessing their pain and entertaining us by their pain.
But yes, I'd make one small caveat. I mean, I see a spectrum, and it runs from the freak show, the circus. I mean, watching Oprah Winfrey, you learn nothing particular other than just to see a spectacle. An extraordinary spectacle. People behaving as freaks, like freaks. It's the equivalent to me of the old circus of going down the pier and say it doesn't enlighten, it doesn't inform. But to use that and then smear what seems to me perfectly reasonable, someone talking about a personal experience or writing, like Ruth Picardy writing about her cancer, or John Diamond recently. Sometimes the critics sniff and they say, it's Oprah Winfrey. But that's like saying that Lear is Oprah Winfrey. You know, that you're seeing on stage this extraordinary, demented, crazy man. But in the portrayal is an understanding, isn't it? Something is learned. You come out of the experience of listening to somebody or seeing somebody having learned something.
Of course you do, but it's very interesting that the Winfrey Show never deals with the things which, for example, Hamlet regards as being... It's very interesting that two of the intolerable burdens which make life insufferable for him as he meditates upon the possibility of suicide in the To Be or Not To Be speech are the insolence of office and the proud man's contumely. Now, never do you ever, in an Oprah Winfrey show, ever hear a boss accused of impudence, insolence, and of proud contumely. What you hear is sexual abuse. So that what has happened is that the bias of explanatory theory is placed upon the sexual and not upon the social.
But it also means that, you see, that whereas if you're talking about Shakespearean times, the psychology, which is interesting, is the psychology of heroes. But, I mean, now the psychology... Now, it's almost a democratization, if you like, of lives, where everybody can claim to have as interesting a life, as meaningful a life, as any hero, any novel, as any hero, any play. It's an extraordinary thing that everybody does, where claimed this land, which was previously only, in fact, controlled by heroes, by the great heroes. Their psychology was interesting. Why did Henry V behave in this way? Why did Hamlet behave in this way? Now, anybody can immediately sort of claim that type of psychological concern for their own life.
Could I just make a little comment about something you said earlier about that somehow counselling or therapy was other people looking for answers asking someone else to control their life? I think it's actually the opposite. It's learning how to take control of your own life, where religion used to tell you how to live your life.
Right.
It's actually going to get guidance to learn how you do it yourself. And it's a lot of people don't know what therapy actually is, and a lot of doctors sitting here doesn't necessarily make sense to some some ordinary person who actually could do with it, that, you know, it's actually about learning. I know what you say is very true. You don't have to have a major thing happen to you to need therapy, but nevertheless, there are bunches of people who have had and who could do with attention, and that needs attention. And then what it's about is learning how to conduct relationships with people. That's all. It isn't even about dwelling on the past and bringing up big, terrible things. It's just about learning how to actually conduct a relationship, firstly with yourself, and therefore...
The last great Archbishop of Canterbury we had, in my estimation, was Archbishop Ramsay. They've all been a whole lot of absolute no-hopers ever since, especially the present one, and I hope this stays in. but he said something rather wonderful about wisdom, because he had big white eyebrows, Archbishop Ramsay. A journalist said to him once, you're a country very wise man, aren't you, your great... He said, am I? I don't know. What do you say? I was wise. He said, well, what do you say wisdom was? He says, wisdom, or I think it's the ability to cope.
In the old days, people used to accept that the lot was bad and that's yes. it and that's your lot.
But being able to cope.
Whereas nowadays, they say, well, no, it doesn't have to be like that. I can actually choose whether I want to be happy or sad or whether what way my life is going to go. I don't have to say that God wants this misery for me or whatever, you know.
Yes.
I think it is very interesting that there's nothing pejorative attached to the notion of going up to someone in the street and asking the way. Now, that is counselling of a sort, but when someone actually goes up to someone who's an expert and asks them the way to be happier, somehow one feels that this, in fact, is you know, slack moral fibre. Now, you might have just as well say it of someone who asks advice in the street. You should have found out where you were going before, and if you had moral fibre, you would have acquainted yourself with the A to Z of the London streets.
But when you're talking so eloquently about people who are suffering, there is another ironical side to this. Your friend Alan Bennett said, with marvellous perception, when he said, quoting that now overdone poem of Larkin, you know, they you up your mum and dad. And if you want to be a writer, that can come in very handy.
Yeah, that's right. Well, listen, I'm going to have to sort of throw a kind of net over you all because, I mean, this could go on forever and it's been simply wonderful and it's somewhat surprised me. I wasn't sure how the conversation would develop. I thought it would turn into a rather typically British rant against the excesses of therapy, and I'm glad to hear, perhaps in our ideologically dead age, some of the politicisation of illness that we're losing perhaps should come back. Now, our next guest is a non-doctor. The loveliest voice this side of the sirens, a bold, wonderful, brave and remarkable artist, the Blessed Virgin Mary in Neil Jordan's superb film The Butcher Boy, the magnificent Sinead with a fodder on the E, O'Connor. Her guitar is tuned, her hair, as always, is down to her knees. She has a song for us, Le Petit Poulet, I believe it's called.
Right, so in Ireland, a term of affection for little children is you call them little chicken or chicken. So this song is, I wrote it about Rwanda, actually, when I heard about what had gone on there, and... that's why I put as much French as I can speak, which is not very much.
Petit poulet, tu ne sais ok, maintenant, baby, tu ne sais ok, the life you left behind. The love you kept inside will come, and even when your own heart blinds you, nothing undoes the work you've done. The sun still in the sky, the moon is there at night, the ground's still underfoot and still holds you. Petit poulet, to signs say okay, maintenant, baby, to signs say okay. There is to the question, you only learn to live with it. There isn't any answer in religion. Don't believe one. child, kissing your plight, kissing your plight. I am the sun up in the sky, I am the moon of summer night, I am the ground under your foot, I am holding you.
Tell me, when did you write that?
I wrote it when I saw on television.
Oh, absolutely, at that time,
yeah. I mean, you know, obviously what went on was pretty horrifying, but I think also many people who come from quite violent circumstances would identify with that, so I guess I identify with the whole thing of, you know, how do you help those children to survive that? And you can't really, except by, you know, put your arms around them.
I've always admired you and felt, in a sense, deeply sorry for you and envious of you, because you've never been afraid to speak your mind about things, and you've got into trouble. You've had been attacked by Frank Sinatra, and then you know, when you tore out the picture of the Pope on television, and you death threats, and goodness knows what else. And of course, criticism from some for playing the Madonna in the Neil Jordan film. Does any part of you feel that you actually go for that? I mean, that you actually like to create a controversy, or do you just feel that it's actually you need to say what you feel, and if people want to attack you, then never mind?
Well, I suppose a bit of both. I mean, I certainly, you know, when I put my first record out or whatever, I was 20. I'm 31 now. I'll be 32 in December, so I'm slightly less volatile than perhaps I would have been in my early 20s. You kind of want to cause trouble at that age and fight everybody, and you project whatever anger you might have about your family or whatever onto everything else, you know. So I guess, yeah, to a certain extent, I wanted to cause trouble, yeah, I guess.
Yes, I remember you did give a very good answer. Some people tell me that I should shut up and sing. How can anybody shut up and sing?
Yeah.
I think it's a very, very good line. Now, I was hoping at this point to hear from Laurie Taylor and Tom Baker, the two doctors, Doctor Who, of course, but they seem to have disappeared in another corner of the studio. Why would that be?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Stephen. Well, in fact, I am over in the corner of the room, and Tom Baker has now joined me on the couch.
Knock, knock. Who's there?
Doctor.
Doctor Who?
Exactly.
Oh. I do. I never heard that before.
You haven't?
No, never.
I've heard hundreds of times.
Really?
And I've never played Doctor Who.
Gosh, that is marvelous. It's so good, yes.
Anyway, but in fact, that little joke touches upon critical ontological issues, in that it raises the whole question of identity. And now, obviously, all actors inevitably experience identity problems. The necessity of separating their own identity from the identity of the character they're playing. But imagine how that problem is compounded when the character you're playing is itself an interrogative pronoun. Who? As in the case of my interviewee today, who you probably guessed already, Tom Baker, in the character of Doctor Who. I was doing it myself. Do you have a firm sense of your own identity?
Oh, I wouldn't go that far. No. I have no highly developed sense of my own uniqueness by any means. And I've noticed, actually, that quite a lot of other people that I meet, like taxi drivers and people like that, have no sense of my identity either. I'm frequently mistaken, for example, for John Pertwee.
John Pertwee. But he's dead, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yes.
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 Have you yourself personally ever been under an analyst?
Well, yes. Yes, I have. I was brought up in analysis from the age of about six to the age of about 21, because I was brought up a very severe Roman Catholic. And so, therefore, I was in analysis, which is called confession. From the age of six, it was the age of six that I began my preparation to become a professional liar. And it was there that, you know, the confession and the ecstasy of absolution that I learned. So, and I consider that to have been, you know, very, very deep analysis.
You enjoyed confessing?
Well, I did enjoy it. I mean, I do remember sometimes, it wasn't all very serious and diminishing. You know, some of it was quite nourishing in a sense that I do remember when I was eight, I confess, I said I'd done murder. That's right. I remember the priest saying it. They always said how many times. I said three times. He said, three times? What, since last Wednesday? I said, yes, Father. He said, anyone we know? I said, no, I said, they were from St. Teresa's, that's the next parish. He said, that's all right then, that's all right.
By the way, I can't help but notice that you're an older man.
Yes, that's right. My wife said that to me this morning, actually. Yes.
Have you, coming up to date rather dramatically, have you considered Viagra?
Well, yes, I mean, I'm very interested in the idea of Viagra, because, of course, like most older men, I'm preoccupied with ecstasy. Mm-hmm. I mean, the feeling, that is.
Yes. I don't know, I must say, I don't really know how Viagra works.
Well, I mean, Viagra, I'm not a, you know, I'm, pharmaceuticals is not my forte, mm-hmm. but I do think that Viagra, as I understand it from The Guardian, so it must be true, is that what it does is it moves the blood from one place to another. It moves the blood to places that other pills or tablets can't get the blood to.
What do you mean, down from the head towards
towards the vital part, well, to the skittle, not to put too fine a point on. Yes, so the blood actually, after Viagra, the blood flows from one part.
How much blood would flow?
Well, it would depend on the size of your skittle. Well, I mean, if the blood flushes out through your head to fill your skittle,
yes.
Therefore,
there could be no blood left.
Well,
in
I mean,
the
if you had an enormous skittle, it would probably empty your head. Yes.
So, what does that mean that you?
Well, it would mean you'd black out.
So you wouldn't really know whether you'd actually done it or not.
No, you wouldn't. No, I'm afraid that's absolutely true. How acute of you, but of course your partner would. Yes.
So they'd be able to remind you. She'd be able to remind you in the morning.
Yes, he would. He would. Yes.
Years. Another rather personal question. Have you ever gone mad?
Yes, I have on several occasions gone mad. But, I mean, of course, I have gone mad professionally because I remember actually when I was asked, since 1885, no actor has ever played Holmes and Moriarty in the same play. I did it in The Mask of Moriarty by Hugh Leonard in Dublin a few years ago.
You were Holmes and Moriarty?
Yes, I was Holmes and Moriarty.
Were they economizing, were they?
The play was written that way. It was very demanding, of course, and there was no time to change. So, instant scenes one after the other. It got very, very strenuous. So people would say, good night, Holmes, and I'd come rushing on, and people would say, hello, Moriarty.
Yes.
And the audience would then say, but it's Holmes again.
But you were presumably wearing different costumes.
No, I was wearing the same costume, but it caused terrible confusion and stress among the audience. And Joseph Heller, there, one of my favorite American writers, he said, my God, you had me thinking tonight, Tom. Yes.
final question on the subject of aging, the general pressures, mm-hmm. the movements which mm-hmm. take place in one's identity and personality, all that sense of that Jungian individuation and everything like that. Can you still manage to put your underpants on while you're standing up?
Well, I wouldn't try it, to be honest. I have got coevals who could do that, but I wouldn't try it myself. I mean, if you caught your little toe in your right hand in the hole of your... You might find yourself hopping around the bedroom and that would be...
Any other symptoms?
Well, I noticed the other day I can't pick up coins in the street anymore.
Yes. Tom Baker, thank you very much for sharing your symptoms with you. and your final record?
Well, I would like a moment of tumultuous applause, if I may.
Of course, and how very appropriate.
Thank you.
thank you very much, Tom Baker. It's extraordinary, I've been sucking skittles all day. And look, oh crikey, darlings, look at the clock. Time, that fell whore like a thief in the night has crept in, rifled my jewel case, pooed in my underwear drawer and taken my video. It's not the loss, it's the sense of violation. I feel stained. Well, time has undone me and undone us all. We must part sadder, if not wiser, a little less foolish perhaps. The Saturday night freight train is drawing from the station. We all have our hankies out, waving a vermilion bandana. Dr. Jonathan Miller, also weeping valedictory tears, Professors Laurie Taylor and Anthony Clare, non-doctor Sinead O'Connor, Doctor Who Tom Baker, nearly a Dr. John Sessions, Dr. Arnold Wesker, and myself, Dr. Stephen Fry, Doctor of Laws, as it happens. So there. To all of you, farewell, and be back soon.